As we talk, research, write, and design for each new topic, we're learning right alongside you. SWDLS is a testament to the best aspects of education, a love letter to all of the great explorers, thinkers, leaders, and creators who made our collective knowledge what it is today.
Everybody, and welcome to the first official episode of Stuff We Don't Learn in School. My name is Jenny.
I'm Victoria.
And today we're joined by a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. So great to be with you, Jenny and Victoria. My name's Catherine.
So Catherine is a very close friend of mine. I've known her ever since I was in diapers. She's probably carried me as a baby whenever I was a child. But Catherine went to the same school district that Vic and I currently go to. She's a Harvard alum. And then afterwards, what did you kind of do?
Yeah, so I graduated from Harvard in 2019 with a degree in psychology and educational studies. This past year, I was teaching in Taiwan on a Fulbright scholarship, and I'm back at Harvard for my master's in education with the Harvard Graduate School of Education, as well as teaching. So a particular program within the grad school that allows me to be at a school in Boston.
Oh my gosh, that's so exciting. So today's podcast, the topic will be about, I don't know if you could guess, but it's about education. So we're going to be talking about our experiences within high school, within college, and beyond, as Catherine is now an educator. So to start off, high school experiences with education. You got anything, Vic?
Oh, man. I'm in the middle. I'm in the middle of it, so I still can't see it from bird's eye view and have a completely objective look on it. I think high school is different from the movies, but
it's no High School Musical.
It's not that, but I think it's a universally almost tough time for everyone since everyone's growing like physically. So you're tired and you're trying to kind of navigate like who you are, what you like doing, which people you want to hang out with. And for me, I would say the one really cool thing about high school is that I was lucky to be surrounded with people who care about me and also wanted to see me be, I guess, the best version, so to speak, or like a version of myself that I didn't think I could be.
Coming from like an outside of high school point of view, Catherine, do you have anything to like add to that?
Yeah, totally. I think that what you mentioned, Victoria, about feeling really lucky to have your teachers, your peers, your school, institution, environment really invest in you and feel as if they really care about you. That's what education should look like. Mm-hmm. You should feel very invested in your community. You should feel as if the older adults in the community are looking out for you, looking out for your well-being, your growth, your learning, your capacity to understand yourself and the world around you. And I mean, I was also fortunate enough to have that experience as well going through the high school we went to, and maybe perhaps from the bird's eye view that I now have, I still look back at my high school experience and feel so incredibly lucky. But to the idea and spirit behind this podcast of stuff that we didn't learn in high school, I'm also recognizing how many gaps I had in my high school education. And also perhaps how many foundational skills in terms of curiosity of learning and curiosity of how to question different things, the critical thinking skills that perhaps I didn't develop as much during my high school experience in ways that I believe youth need now.
I completely agree. Would you say that like going into college helped you become curious and start questioning all of these things around you and developing those critical thinking skills that you found did have a gap in high school?
Yes, but it was a very long process. And in many ways, I almost feel like the past few months of being at home and seeing the ways in which COVID has exacerbated the inequities in our society, the ways in which the Black Lives Matter movement has sparked a lot of conversations again about the inequities in our society, that I now am training to become an educator myself. People oftentimes say that when you can teach it, you really understand it. And mm-hmm. I think now in my training to be a teacher, I'm also understanding how a lot of the things that the ways in which I learn things were, are not the ways that I would want to teach students. And so when you ask about whether or not these critical lenses, whether or not I began questioning things in college, yes, but it was not as intentional as it is now. It would have been a little bit more accidental. I might have just bumped into some sort of knowledge area in which I didn't know as much, and maybe my professor was able to guide me through it, but not in the same way that now as an educator thinking about how can I teach these skills to kids, I feel as if I'm in the same learning process in some ways.
Yeah.
So I almost feel like it's a lifelong thing. I think I'm going to continue developing. One of my favorite things from a book that I had read was that we're all in the process of growing, no matter how old we get. And I definitely feel that now. There was probably a time when I graduated high school that I was like, you know what? This is great. I have a lot to learn, but I still learned a lot.
This is
it. I realized when I came to college, wow, there's so much I don't know. And I feel that even more saliently now, that like the more I know I don't know anything. And so definitely a process of developing skills, definitely a process of filling in the gaps with counter narratives of stories that I was just not exposed to.
Yeah. I think doing speech and debate, doing original oratory, Victoria and I have heard so many different stories and so many different perspectives, but you going into the real world, traveling to Taiwan or starting to become an educator, you really get to see those perspectives. And like understanding all these different things.
Totally. Again, I feel so grateful for the opportunities that I was given to step outside of my immediate circle. And I think, for example, one of the moments in which I realized there was one of those gaps was when I was teaching and mentoring at a school in South Africa. And I realized the first conversation I'd ever had about apartheid, the first conversation in which I heard about was when I was in South Africa, which is when I was in college.
Yeah.
And that to me was just astounding that this entire history that was in many ways very recent, that at that point in time, they were still creating their constitution. They were still having these conversations on land reparations, that it was a conversation I was just stepping into and just learning about. And that's how I feel about so many places. Someone who is now going to be teaching world history. I'm coming into that as well. What narratives do we include? What narratives, like, do we have the time to talk about in the span of a year? As I think about this academic year with my students, I'm just constantly recognizing how much more of the world is yet to be explored.
I think it's crazy that we haven't talked about the apartheid at all in school. Like, South Africa, period.
Yeah, maybe just human geo once, but that's it.
Perhaps, like, a little bit in seventh grade.
Yeah.
Nope, that's it.
And to offer a counter perspective to that is every time I learn something, there's always the sense of, why didn't I know this before? Like, why was I exposed to this before? But there's also just infinite amounts of knowledge out there. Mm-hmm. And there's not enough time. An entire year diving to the history of South Africa.
That's true.
We don't have those types of courses that are focused on that. And a way in which I would say that we can start moving towards that in schools is having a less Eurocentric curriculum. I know that our high school only offered European history. There was no larger world history within different continents, really other than Europe, that I remember. And of course, you're not going to cover every single country. I struggle with that now when I think about teaching about South America. Do I cover Brazil, Argentina, Chile? Like, there's so many places to cover. So how do you be thoughtful about the skills, again, that you're teaching students, and how to unearth these conversations and narratives for themselves?
I think what you mentioned about teaching students skills in order to allow them to uncover it for themselves is really interesting, since, again, there's so much knowledge, we can't know everything. And depending on, like, what students are interested in, they can learn more and develop, I guess, like, a more niche understanding in the field. And I wanted to ask you, in high school specifically, since I think that's a time of really large growth for everyone, just, again, in terms of height, but also personality, oh my gosh, interests, what you like. And also there are AP classes, I think IB classes that I think try to prepare you for college with more like course curriculum, but also there's stricter regulations on what you can teach since there's a test at the end of the year. So students can get a okay score. And if they do, they're able to save money for college. I was just wondering, what do you think high school education can look like in the future? And I guess what we can do now, or what teachers could do now, to lean more into teaching skills, even with restrictions on curriculum, just given the classes.
Totally. And for this, I look towards pioneers in the field of particular abolitionist teaching. So people such as Bettina Love, Goldie Muhammad, Dena Simmons, who have done such amazing work. As you think about how do we, like you mentioned, have these acts of resistance for educators in this larger system that can bring about inequities or disadvantage some, such as a state mandated test, mm-hmm. such as curriculum that's a certain way. How do you, as an educator, think about your scope of influence within a classroom? And here are some of the ways in which they have mentioned that high school educators can bring in these acts of resistance. One is recognizing, yes, we need to shift learners from being dependent to independent, meaning that, like you mentioned, giving them the skills to be able to create and understand and look for knowledge that does not depend on a teacher and or a curriculum to give them that. But beyond that is not just thinking about skills, but how do our lessons help our students become smart about things other than skills? And so what I mean by this is, how do our lessons help students learn about their identity? How do our lessons teach our students new places, peoples, things, histories that are not as taught as much? But yeah, but that is some of the things that they mention in regards to what are the small acts of resistance that teachers can do. And mm-hmm. a part of it too is recognizing, one, the humanity and in all students, holding all students to high expectations.
Yes.
But then also in regards to, for example, my current curriculum as a ninth grade world history teacher, I'm lucky enough in that I do not have these current larger state tests that are like imposing on me. And so when I think about creating my curriculum, how do I think about bringing in the primary and secondary sources that, again, will bring in narratives that students might not be exposed to in other places? And I remember something that was very salient to me is that a majority of students don't take history after high school. And so your high school history education is the high school is the history that you understand. But history is happening all the time, every single day. And only by understanding the past can we understand the future, and the future that we want to envision, and the society that we want to create.
Is that kind of why you decided to do, I mean, I don't know if this was your decision, but to teach ninth grade world history?
So for me, I was specifically interested in teaching history in general. I got placed within ninth grade world history and I could not be more stoked, but history as a discipline itself was what was very exciting to me about that was, again, what I mentioned of people think of history as the past, but history is so alive.
Yes.
We're living through a historical moment right now. Who knew that COVID was going to come in 2020?
Nobody knew
that our world would be in the state that it is today? And some of the more illuminating things about the way in which we handle and governments have responded to this crisis right now is by looking at their history. You see a lot of countries in Asia responding very well because they've had histories with SARS in the past. Mm-hmm. You talk about what the last major outbreak in the US was the 1918 Spanish influenza. And by unearthing these narratives, by unearthing these histories, by looking to the past to learn, is a huge way, and again, in which we can reimagine a new society, in which we can see what are the steps that we can take to come out of it? What are the ways in which people have been fighting for a long time for example, healthcare for all, and looking at the situations that we're in now and trying to see where are the gaps and inequities that have been, again, exacerbated by a pandemic.
Exactly. I think so many people are jaded by this term history. Like, it's almost become a meme at this point. Like, the only reason you would ever major in history is to become, like, a historian or a history teacher. But people don't realize the true importance of understanding history, not just, you know, memorizing the names of all of these old white men who have made a major influence in U.S. history, but also understanding the history of the world, which is essentially what you will be teaching, and understanding how that history, what does genuinely relate to today. And like you said, the Spanish influenza relates to now COVID, and how other historical moments within just the past century will probably majorly influence how society dictates itself within these next couple of years.
Yeah, history right now is probably the subject that's being reexamined the most. Yes. And like you mentioned, like, what narratives do you cover in school? Because people know history. It's just like, what story are you buying into and what story are you trying to listen to? And I wanted to ask you that. Are you ever afraid, as an educator who specifically teaches history, to include acts of resistance? I was talking to a couple of teachers, and sometimes they echoed like sentiments of being afraid because there's also parents whenever you're making curriculum, and sometimes that can get messy, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
For sure. I wanted to, so I'll answer this, and I'll touch on something that you mentioned too, Jenny, about just the idea of history as a whole. So Victoria, in your question about do you include acts of resistance, I would say absolutely. For every oppression that you talk about in our world, you need to include acts of resistance. Our world, our country's history has been built on imperialism, on colonialism, on taking land, on colonizing and all of that. And through that, there's been so many brave moments of resistance. And I would be interested, for example, when parents push back against resistance, what do they mean by that? Do they mean resistance as in large scale rebellion, such as what we saw with the Arab Spring, with someone lighting himself on fire to start resistance against oppressive governments? Like, I'd be interested in what people define as resistance, because resistance can be the things that are like boycotting the buses that we learn about in American history. And resistance can be refusing to do something. Resistance can look like Malala deciding to go to school every day in the face of Taliban. And so when you talk about resistance, what I think of is acts of bravery. It's not this image of what people imagine as violence, but it's bravery in the force of, in the wake of oppressive violence that I think is very important to teach, because it shows the resilience of so many humans. And to what you mentioned, Jenny, about the discipline of history and people thinking about what it means to be a historian, I would argue that all of us should be historians, because the skills of being a historian are the skills that make you check bias, that make you look at what am I reading. So for example, you go to Twitter, you see a tweet that is from young Democrats or young Republicans, and you look at this handle and you look more into, where did this come from? Who is this from? Who backs this? Who's writing this? That skill is the skill of sourcing, which is exactly the skill that historians use. And I would argue that it's probably the skills that come from what it means to be a historian are even more relevant to today, because we need to constantly look at the information we're consuming, ask ourselves where it's coming from, ask ourselves what biases it holds, who is writing it, and whether or not we can trust it. And that's the same with people, with news, with anything. That's what I think of when it means to be a historian. So while I myself don't spend time poring over previous documents like over and over, I am practicing the skills of being a historian every single day when I read the news.
Yeah, I think it's this concept of just like, as cheesy as it sounds, keeping an open mind, not getting trapped into just looking at news articles that fit your perspective, or in other words, just confirmation bias. I've never thought of it like that, but that's a really, really good way to put it. Especially now, like you said, now more than ever in an era of Instagram infographics and tweets by major political figures, it's more important than ever to like understand sourcing and understand where things are coming from. Because Victoria and I had this conversation with our team, how there's this one Instagram infographic that was very popular and was shared by a lot of people. But if you did the math that they were doing, it didn't work out at all.
Yeah, I was literally like that one person who was like, oh my gosh, guys, this is so cool. And then they're like, Victoria, this doesn't make sense. So sourcing is definitely relevant.
It's misinformation can go a long, long way.
And the skill that you're talking about, fact-checking, is a skill that we do in history too, which is corroboration, is looking at a lot of other sources to make sure this information is correct, not just trusting one thing, but looking at other sources that are coming from different places. And so you're exactly right. And then contextualizing things. What does this mean in the larger world? And why is someone talking about this? What is the stories that are missing from here? And so just so many of these skills that come from the history discipline, again, I think are so, so relevant.
Yeah.
For history specifically, since I think STEM a lot of the times is viewed as not political, objective, even though there are some like biases within it, I think history, if I'm not wrong, and like, please correct me, is kind of like telling a giant story. And since it's a story, it has to, I guess, like by default oversimplify things. I wanted to ask, like within curriculum, whenever you're planning, and for other educators who are in the same field, how do you choose what to tell, and how do you talk to other educators who might not agree with stories you want to tell or you want to cover now, and with everything happening?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So I totally agree with the idea of history being a large narrative, a large story. It's exciting because it's storytelling. When I think about what stories to include and how to tell that narrative, you're exactly right. Like one, there's a very finite time that you have. I have 40 minutes every day with my students and I need to cover the entire world. So I'm spending 6 weeks on each continent, but how much can 6 weeks tell you about every single continent, you know? And so I think a part of our role as educators is provide the initial sets of materials, the initial tools for students to dig in and allow them to explore and give them the creativity. And a lot of my final assessments are going to be very project-based, are going to allow them to explore what they're excited about. And again, that means that for everything that you spend your time on, you're not spending your time on something else. For like in every curriculum, you add something in, you have to cut something out. Time is finite. What you teach in a set year is going to be finite, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk to other educators about what types of narratives to include, that's oftentimes it comes from one, are there any larger structures that are in place? So for example, are there state standards that have been written out for you to cover? So Massachusetts, where I am in now, they have an entire history and social studies framework for educators to help guidepost their thinking. And that's different than Pennsylvania. That's different than Tennessee. That's different than California. And that's a system in which educators need to work inside of first and foremost. But to the individual, again, acts of resistance of the specific primary documents, the specific secondary documents that you use to teach about a certain history. In my opinion, that's the beauty of education. That's the beauty of being an educator, is that you can decide to choose that and decide to include what histories. And I know there's going to be a lot of educators that I don't agree with about what histories to include, but that's also the beauty of learning, of being a student, is that the students can question that. Students should be critical in their classrooms of being like, is this the entire narrative? The entire story? What things are we missing? What perspectives are not here? And those are the critical questions that students should constantly be encouraged to ask, so that it is not up to the teacher to just give you all the narratives, but it's up to the student to uncover and unearth what narratives are missing.
That is such a good point. I feel like what's amiss in classrooms right now is the encouragement of students to question the curriculum or to question what the teacher is saying. Not necessarily like go against every single thing that they're saying. Like if the curriculum is talking about like math, so say it's like algebra one and they're questioning why is 2 - 3 - 1. Not necessarily that, but I remember specifically I had an English teacher who was obviously leaning towards one side of the political spectrum. And we would talk about very controversial issues such as gun rights. But he would guide the discussion in a way that didn't allow for the opposing political view to ever, quote unquote, win or to ever be seen in a positive light. And I think that is so, so dangerous, especially since it just seemed like in that classroom, like nobody with a different opinion was ever allowed to speak their mind on these topics.
I do think, like what Jenny said, it's interesting how different teachers decide to navigate their classroom and how they teach. And the idea of not switching the power structure, but having students and giving them the freedom to question the curriculum and also question the, I guess, environment they're in is something that's necessary and also I don't think is talked about enough. But like Jenny said, what do you think the role of an educator should play in the classroom? I know you talked about helping students feel like they belong, but in the context of facilitating discussions versus, I guess, like participating in them, since I think teachers a lot of the times have a certain responsibility where they can't be biased towards one side and then ultimately swing like students' views because of that. How do you navigate that?
Totally. That's also a really great question. I love the way that you both are thinking right now, because these are the conversations that need to be happening of where's the boundaries of things, where can we push them, and where do we know our limits? And so for me, as I think about this as an educator, there are many, many different times where my role is to be a co-creator in the classroom and to facilitate conversation. Something that I did in our school training today was thinking about this larger assessment question of one of the conversations that we had during our training today was looking at an assessment task in which the question was President Truman justified in dropping the bomb during World War II? And that's a really great question to have students critically think. And some students may think it was justified based upon all of the evidence that was given. Some students may not. And I do think that my role as an educator is to facilitate that critical thinking. But I also do think that teaching is political. And I do think that there are many different ways in which I am allowed to express my own opinion in the classroom, particularly on the things that I do not believe should be questioned. And so when it comes to hate speech, when it comes to conversations that need to be critically examined and talked about, for me, it's not a matter of shutting people down, but it's a matter of when is this a teaching moment to actually say, what you said was not okay, and it endangers other students in the classroom, and let's have a conversation about it, rather than, actually, I totally hear what you say. Tell me more about that. I think there are different times in which you should be asking students, how do you critically think about these larger questions that help them live out their values in society? And students may disagree with me on this, and I'd be so happy to welcome them that question and welcome those those debates in my classroom, but there are some things that I do not believe need to be a debate. And for me, those are the teaching moments that will be really important for me as an educator.
Yeah. I think that's like so hard to ride that fine line of disciplining a certain open mindset while at the same time teaching them into being a good person within society.
Yeah. And I wouldn't necessarily say that any of this is extreme measures of disciplining in any way. I would use the language of having really open conversations about hard topics and welcoming that. And also knowing that my lens as an educator is that at times there's a lot of unconscious ignorance, and that's okay. That's what school is for. It's for us to learn. And as an educator, my role and my perspective that I'll always come from is one of love and care. And I'll tell you the honest truth because I believe in your full potential to grow. And I'm going to give you the grace to grow. I'm not shunning you about your lack of knowledge because I don't know how many years ago now, 9 years ago, that was me. I was also an unconsciously ignorant person too. And I was just lucky that I had educators and friends and mentors and peers who gave me the grace to grow as well.
Yeah. Okay, so shifting gears a little bit, I kind of want to talk about your experience becoming an educator, because for as long as I've known you, I've looked up to kind of you and your sister and the other family friends that we have, along with, you know, my brother and his wife. I've kind of looked up to all of you as these influential people within my lives. And you all have kind of decided to take all of these different routes. And so I'm so interested in asking you, like, what made you choose becoming an educator? As an Asian American, you know, I feel a lot of pressure through social expectations or through perhaps other friends to become, you know, a doctor or an engineer, a computer scientist. So how did you kind of break that mold?
Yeah, I want to validate that there's a lot of pressures that come in society, whether it's from the larger societal forces, whether it's from our peers, whether it's from our loved ones. That's a very real thing. And I think that for me, I was extremely lucky in the latter ends of particularly my loved ones, such as my family, were so supportive of what I wanted to do. And I particularly credit my parents in always pushing me to adopt a lens of where can I continue to make impact. And my dad would always say two of the biggest fields to do that in are education and healthcare. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was education. I always felt like an educator at heart. But that doesn't mean that I didn't feel the other pressures, namely of peers and of the larger society. A conversation that will always stick in my mind was right before I graduated high school, talking about one of our plans in college, and a friend asking me, so what are you planning on doing? And I said, you know what? I'm really excited about thinking about becoming a teacher. And she mentioned, oh, Catherine, don't go to Harvard to become a teacher. You can go to our community college and come back to our school and teach. And that really stuck with me because at the time when you are 18 years old, you are, of course, thinking about wanting your peers' approval. And even now, it's still sometimes hard to shake off. Of course, I want to be accepted by my peers, but it took a lot of really intentional and serendipitous encounters with mentors in education, with peers who were so encouraging and those whom inspired me, frankly, to be in more public service-esque fields when the larger society or community valued maybe one that is of money. And so for me, when I think about how I ended up finding my way and sticking on the path of education, I completely credit that to the communities I was a part of that continued to be encouraging. And so, for example, educational studies was not a academic discipline that I could take in college until my senior year, because I, along with some of my peers, fought for it to be institutionalized. So beforehand, there was no formal way to study education or anything like that. It might have been random one-off courses, but now at our college, there's an institutional way to study it. And having that community and being one of the first graduating classes to say I'm like graduating with a minor in educational studies has been such a big blessing for me. And a big part of the push at that time was having that community, having a group of people who are doing the same thing. I think cohort models, I think that having friends, having loved ones, having mentors who just unconditionally encourage you on your journey and or question you when you are straying off that path are some of the reasons why I believe that I was able to, if you want to say, quote unquote, break the mold of what society kind of shepherds students, or whether it's Asian Americans, whether it's women, whether it's blank, blank, blank identity into doing. I would definitely credit that with the people in my life.
That's amazing. I remember you always talk about like how much you love your experience at Harvard, how much college kind of has opened your eyes to a lot of things. Is that kind of what you mean by that? These communities and these groups that kind of have showed you a different way to think and a different way to kind of live your life.
Totally. And there was a lot of things that were not great about my college experience too. And those are the things, again, those moments of highs and those moments of lows, they all shape you into understanding what it is that you want to do. And so when we talk about education, it really sucked not coming into this school and not immediately being able to identify with other group of first year students who felt like they were on the same path with me. And now being in a program at the Graduate School of Education where everyone there is an educator and is so passionate and excited. And within my particular program, everyone is teaching. That is such a difference in the way in which I relate to communities and those around me. But I would not have been seeking them out had I not been lost in the first place, which definitely happened when I first got to college, was feeling lost, feeling like, where can I find that community? And so, again, of course, love the experience and has shaped me, but it has done that because of a lot of highs and a lot of lows.
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't know. I feel very lost right now. So that's very refreshing to hear.
No, I agree.
Okay. Well, I mean, do you have anything to add, Victoria?
One thing I want to say is, like Jenny mentioned briefly, it is really reassuring to hear someone who's gone through college and has chosen education and see them kind of like in our life.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings me more confidence to do what I want, since I also think I want to do something education-based, or maybe something that leans, I guess, more towards like an unconventional path or what society doesn't really push you towards. And it's just cool.
I'm so blessed to have like Catherine in my life, and my sister-in-law is also an educator. So I'm blessed to have her in my life as well, just to show me that you can be such an insanely amazing inspiration to so many people in not a conventional way. Thank you, Catherine.
Yeah.
You're too sweet. And to what you said, Victoria, I hope that you continue having that confidence to pursue the things you want to. And when that confidence dips, as it will inevitably do, like dip, that I hope that you have people who will lift you up and know that I, for one, will unconditionally support you and guide you through that journey, because I had so many people doing that for me too. And I think a part of what it means to be an educator, what it means to see all of our lives intersect with one another, is the idea of giving back. And so I'm so excited to follow both of your journeys and unconditionally support you guys through it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And you know, like, even though I'm in this role as an educator now, it doesn't mean that sometimes I still don't feel lost. Of course, like, there are times where I'm also thinking about wow, like you mentioned before, the larger structure is like, how can I continue bringing in acts of resistance into my classroom? How do I think about the larger school system? How do I think about the larger educational system in the US? And then also the educational systems in other countries too. Like,
yeah.
You know, there's always these larger issues on your mind, but focus on the here and now. What is your sphere of influence? What are the things that you can do? What are the ways you can challenge yourself? And who are the people that you can lean on to ensure that you're being guided to ask those questions and also being supported in the things that you find exciting and the ways in which you want to serve the world?
Yeah.
That was that was beautiful. I feel really uplifted right now. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna go and
yes.
Get it.
Oh my gosh. Do you have kind of any last words, Catherine, before we kind of end this off? I mean, you've said enough. You've said more than enough, I think. But if you have anything to add.
Not too many words that have not already been spoken, mm-hmm. but just for example, a conversation that I had today with a mentor was on doing a lot of self-reflection on my current role now and thinking about what are the ways that I've changed and have grown from being a student. What are the different ways that I want to show up in community? And I would encourage you both and everyone to continually do that self-reflection. I think that it perhaps was one of the most important ways for me to grow in college, was taking the time and being very intentional about it to ask myself those questions. What do I believe in? What are my values? How do my actions align with my values? How do I continue showing up in this world? Who do I want to be as a person? And recognizing that you are going to change and embracing that. And just continuing on that iterative process. It's one that I'm still doing now, and one that I still realize I have weaknesses, insecurities, vulnerabilities that I just want to be very honest and open with myself with, because only by understanding ourselves are we able to uplift others and be there for them in the ways that we want to show up.
Period.
Yeah.
I mean... Hi guys, this is Editing Jenny here. We just got so caught up in the conversation that we forgot to remind you to make sure to follow us on our Instagram, which is at Stuff We Don't Learn in School, and make sure to sign up for our newsletter. So if you go to our website, which is stuffwedontlearninschool.org, you can just plug in your email and you will get a newsletter once every 2 weeks. This week is our first newsletter on education, and it's absolutely amazing. It's hilarious. It's a great, fun read, so we highly suggest that you go sign up for that. Okay, and on that note, I think, wow, I kind of chose this quote out of randomness, but it's so fitting for this podcast.
It is so fitting.
So we're going to end with this quote. It's from the Michelle Obama podcast, actually, which she recently just started to air, which is amazing. If you guys haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. For those of you who don't know who Michelle Obama is, you should Google her name. Just learn everything that you can about that woman. She's amazing. We love her. But in her intro podcast, at around 5 minutes, one of her guests said a quote that I immediately wrote down and then FaceTimed Victoria about, because I needed to tell her and we needed to discuss about it immediately. But the quote is, "You have to give yourself permission to be something different than what the world expects you to be."